This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Everybody has a right to be clean. Everyone has access to water and sanitation just like you do in your home. And imagine what your life would be like if you couldn't take a shower.
Do you live in a city? Well, if you don't, you may soon. It's predicted that by 2050, more than 70% of us human beings will be living in cities. The urban landscape offers several advantages for sustainability, including reduced transportation emissions, more efficient water delivery, and less per capita energy consumption. But those of us who live in cities know there are also disadvantages. Today on Sea Change Radio, we speak with two innovative thinkers who are working on solutions to a couple of the problems of city living. Our first guest is Donis Sandoval, whose company Lava May recycles buses and transforms them into mobile showers for people who cannot access sanitation, many of whom live on our urban streets. We talk about the model, the mission, and the vision of replicating these bathroom buses in cities everywhere. Next, we dig into the archives to revisit my discussion with Dixon Despommier, microbiologist and vertical farming advocate. He tells us why he believes growing food in skyscrapers would conserve water and fossil fuels, and how it could become the way cities get food in the not-so-distant future. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Donis Sandoval. She's the founder of Lava May. Donis, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So for our listeners around the country, why don't you tell us what Lava May is? What is the concept?
Well, we began by taking public transportation buses and converting them into showers and toilets on wheels for the homeless. But we launched our pilot 2.5 years ago. And since then, we've not only expanded, but deepened our programming. And now we consider what we do is, you know, transforming the way that communities see and serve people moving through homelessness.
And take a step back to the inspiration behind it. What motivated you to do this?
Homelessness is an issue that I've cared about for a long time. I moved back to San Francisco from New York in 2002 and was really astounded at the number of people who were living on the street. And I knew that I wanted to do something to help. I also knew that people needed housing. So I thought long and hard and realized that that was not something that I could really help people with. But I'm an ideas person, and I just said that if I would keep my eyes open, surely I would find a need that I might be able to help with. And essentially, within a very short period of time, I passed a young woman on the street who was saying over and over again to herself that she would never be clean. And it made me wonder what her chances were for getting physically clean, because every visibly homeless person I had seen was struggling with hygiene. And so I went online to do the research, and what I found out really shocked me, that for the 7,500 people who are homeless in this city, there are essentially 7 drop-in centers during the day where they can go to use showers and toilets, and that totaled about 16 shower stalls and about as many toilets, which was appalling. And that's a problem that you would expect perhaps in the third world, not in the United States, and certainly not in one of the most affluent cities in this country. And so very shortly thereafter, I saw an article in the Chronicle about Muni retiring their old diesel buses. And inspired by the mobile food truck movement, I started thinking we should take those buses and convert them into showers and toilets. And so Lava May was born.
And how many people do you serve now? And explain how the technology works, what you've put into these buses, if you will.
So, you know, my first vision was to put as many showers in there as possible. So we were going to put up to 7 or 6 or other showers and a toilet in there. And then we realized that we needed to go out and talk to people and find out what they really wanted. I mean, it's ridiculous to create something for people without involving people in the design. So we spent a lot of time on the streets having one-on-one conversations, and even hosted a focus group. And we heard 3 things over and over again. The first was that if you're homeless, you live your entire life in the public eye. You never have a moment of privacy. You can imagine how stressful that must be. Second, if you are a woman or you're LGBTQ, the incidence of attack in a shower where there's one, more than one shower, is really incredibly high. And then lastly, if you're disabled, and about 60% of the population suffers some form of disability, that it's really difficult to find a place that meets your needs and also keeps you safe. So we revamped our whole thinking about the design and decided that we would put two full bathrooms with shower, toilet, sink, and a small changing area on these buses. The front unit is fully ADA compliant, so it's quite spacious. We also decided that design was really important. The research has shown that beautiful design can really lift people's spirits. So we opted to add in skylights, we pipe in music, and we were very thoughtful about the color scheme that we used. As I said earlier, we launched our pilot in June of 2014, and since that time have provided over 2,400 homeless San Franciscans with over 14,000 showers.
And how can somebody access your showers around the city? How do they learn about it, and where can they find you?
We have a set schedule, and you can find the information on our website. We also partner with other nonprofits. So every day that we're out there, you know, in tandem with another nonprofit, parking close by their facilities so that we can serve their guests. And word spreads pretty quickly about where you're going to be. So people have yet to have any trouble finding us, unless, sadly, if we're out of service because a bus needs to be maintained or something. You know, then they're like, well, where are you? And we're working really hard to try and, you know, keep people abreast of those kinds of changes. But otherwise, we have a very set schedule.
And as you expand, how do you plan on reusing buses in the future? Will there be a steady stream of bus supply for you moving ahead?
And that's a really good question, because what we've learned over the time that we've been doing this is that the buses are actually incredibly challenging, and for reasons it might seem surprising, here in San Francisco in particular, we are competing with the shuttle bus companies that, you know, transport tech employees back and forth between the valley. And it's very difficult to find a pool of drivers. We pay well, but we don't start our pay at $35 an hour. Secondly, you have to care about this issue. And then thirdly, you have to have great customer service skills, because what we've learned is how you deliver the service is as important as the service itself. And we do something we call radical hospitality, which is about providing an unexpected level of care and really connecting human to human. So it made us think long and hard about whether the buses were a viable model as we looked at expansion. And in fact, this past April, we switched to a commercial shower trailer. The additional advantage that that provides us with is that in the same footprint, we can have three full bathrooms as opposed to the two, so we can meet greater need. So as we continue to expand, we'll open our branch in Los Angeles in November. We will be launching with the commercial shower trailer.
That was my next question, was how do you plan on scaling this? You said Los Angeles is your next destination. Do you think this is a replicable model beyond your organization? Why aren't more communities latching onto this?
They are. We've inspired over 15 projects around the globe that have used our model. We've helped some of them rather extensively, providing design, providing consultation, and others have just, you know, read about us and seen us and been inspired to go out and start their own. We also have a list of 1,200 communities around the world who are waiting for our toolkit, which we plan to release in December.
And talk about some of the partners that have enabled you to do what you do.
Well, we believe in bringing everybody at the table. So obviously this started with getting a partnership with the city of San Francisco, the different departments who we would touch. So for example, SF Water, we tap into fire hydrants in order to supply our showers. We rent the meter, we pay for our water, but they made it possible for us to do that. SF MTA donated the buses. They also help us with parking. And then across the spectrum, you know, on the nonprofit side, we have many nonprofit partners who both helped us shape our service and who work in tandem with us to expand the services that can be offered so that people can do more than just shower. They can get a range of services from you know, case management, to healthcare, to mental health services. And then we also partner with the private sector who do more than just, you know, fund our work. They come out and they provide volunteers and additional in-kind services. So our vision is, or our belief is, that it's going to take all of us. And so we work across the sectors.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Donis Sandoval. She's the founder of Lava May, which is a nonprofit that provides showers to everybody. So, Donis, you came up with this idea in the midst of this drought that California is still suffering from. And how did that inform your strategy?
Well, it informed our strategy by making us very conscious of the fact that we wanted to have as light a footprint as possible. When the news broke after our crowdfunding campaign went live about our story, we were contacted by the head of sustainability at Kohler, who does beautiful bath fixtures, and they wanted to be a partner with us to help us, you know, deliver our service, and worked very closely with us to use a line of their products that really focused on low water usage. And within a very short period of time after launching our service, we circled back with SF Water, and we found out actually our water usage was indeed quite low. Every blue moon, we'll have someone in the community, you know, say to us, you know, how can you be using water to shower homeless people? And our response to them is simply, everybody has a right to be clean. Everyone has access to water and sanitation just like you do in your home. And imagine what your life would be like if you couldn't take a shower. And what opportunities would be missed if you couldn't get cleaned up? Your job, your housing, all sorts of things. And so, you know, we feel like we work very hard to be conscientious about the impact that we're having. We recognize that there's a drought, but we also believe that everyone has the right to be clean.
So you mentioned crowdfunding. How can listeners support Lava May as you continue to provide showers to the homeless?
There's a host of ways. Obviously, financial support is always great. You can go to our website, which is lavamae.org, and donate. But we also love and need to have volunteers in order to deliver our service. So out there on the streets with us, getting to know our guests, or even behind the scenes, if people want to work in the back of the house with us. We also invite people to consider doing, you know, hygiene drives. If you travel a lot, save your travel-sized products and send them to us, because we share those with our guests so that they can keep up with their hygiene in between visits with us.
And you mentioned the toolkit that people can plug into if they want to try to replicate your model in their communities. How does that work?
Well, so we're putting the finishing touches on it. It will live online and it will be downloadable. Phase one will be ready before the end of the year, and then we will deepen that program. But our goal is to help anyone out there who sees a need in their community and is really committed to bringing their service to the people who are in need. So it would be as simple as going to our website. There'll be a very clear tab in the navigation bar, and then you would be able to download the information.
She's the founder of Lava May, Donis Sandoval. Donis, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I was the king of the alley. I could talk a trash. I was the prince of the pauper's crown downtown at the beggar's bash. I was a pimp's main prophet, I kept everything cool. Just a backstreet gambler with the luck to lose. And when the heat came down and it was left on the ground, the devil appeared like Jesus through the steam in the street, showing me a hand I knew even the cops couldn't beat. I felt his hot breath on my neck as I dove into the heat. It's so hard to be a saint when you're just a boy out on the street.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Dr. Dixon Depommier. His new book is The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century. Dr. Depommier is an emeritus professor of public health and microbiology at Columbia University. Dick, Welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much.
So this idea of vertical farming is not a new one. Can you walk us through a little bit of how the idea has evolved?
Sure. Back in the 1930s, when hydroponics first came into vogue, people began to imagine raising food plants now, crops, off of soil and in buildings. And so that's when the greenhouse industries basically started. UC Davis was the place where hydroponic farming first became perfected, and nutrient systems began to work out, and they worked on lighting issues and, you know, temperature regimes and oxygen levels and roots and all kinds of other interesting scientific projects. But eventually they perfected it to the point where anybody who wanted to grow plants indoors using hydroponic technologies, which means soilless, water-based growing, could get involved. And in fact, there was a popular movement back in the 30s, as you know, called Victory Gardens, sort of an attempt to grow our own food. It extended into the 40s as well to take care of the issues of supplying enough food for our troops and to keep the home front also well fed. It was a very difficult, delicate balance. And the government encouraged the average citizens to start their own gardens, and many of them relied on hydroponics. And in fact, in the South Pacific, during the Second World War, because supply chains were broken by Japanese torpedoes and gunboats, hydroponic farming took off in the South Pacific as well, and we raised some 8,000 tons of food before the end of the Second World War. And then after the war, of course, everybody went back to business as usual. But in the meantime, there were hints that things were not all the way they should be. And of course, John Steinbeck's book, The Grapes of Wrath, one which I do feature in my book as an example of what happened to farming, emerged as the biggest problem facing the 20th century and then well into the 21st century as well. So today, back in the 1980s, let's say, it became apparent that farming and population growth were not going to keep pace with each other. And in fact, with the climate change issues that we began to experience and losses of crops and still with increasing populations, it became apparent that some other farming strategy had to be worked out, if not for the people that were alive then, that saying back in 1980s, 1990, we were approaching 6.5 billion people at that point. Certainly for the next 2 or 3 billion people that would appear over the next 20 to 40 years, what are you going to do about them, even if you can supply enough food for the people that are alive now? You can't continue to farm this way and expect to feed another 2 billion people.
Now, there are people like yourself and other quote-unquote futurists who are looking at this as one answer to try to feed this inevitable influx of people on the planet.
So that's exactly right. What are you going to do about them? Are you just going to ignore them and stick your head in the sand and pretend that there's no problem? Or are you going to research and find out that there are plenty of other ways of farming that are more efficient and that bring the food closer to where people live? You know, just farming indoors is not the only way to do that, by the way. There are plenty of other outdoor farm strategies which preserve soil and which take advantage of things like permaculture, inserting carbon into the soil in the form of charcoal and things of this sort, which does improve farming.
I saw a really cool picture in the book of outdoor vertical farming in a very modest scale in the picture, but the hydro stacking.
Oh, yeah.
Tell our listeners what that's all about.
Clever approach to saving land and raising an intensive farming at the same time. They are plastic stands with a large, wide, round base upon which emerge four potting zones, all right, or potting plants, I should say. And so you get four per stand, and each one stacks into the other, so you can get multiples of four as high as maybe 10 or 15 feet. So that let's say you can get eight hydro-stacked growing units per, let's say, 2 square feet. I mean, that's 32 plants per square foot.
Ed Glaser from Harvard has written a book called Triumph of the City, which is a clarion call for increased urbanization as one of the solutions for the population boom. Do you see vertical farming being part and parcel with this increased urbanization movement, or do you think some of the best ideas out there for stackable vertical farms are separate from population centers?
Well, no, I agree with Professor Glaser's approach to looking at the way people behave, and that is we're gregarious. We tend to associate in groups, large groups. We like those large groups because they offer many social services that you can't get by living as individuals in the countryside. They allow our children to go to higher quality schools. They certainly connect us up with our ancestors and our future ancestors as well. It allows for a higher level of communication, I would say. And I think people in general are programmed this way. I think we're wired when we're born to communicate with each other, and that's where our gift of speech comes from, and all these other wonderful qualities of being a human being. So if we choose to live in cities, there's no reason in the world why we shouldn't choose to grow our food there too.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the author of The Vertical Farm, Dr. Dixon Despommier. Dick, vertical farming is more than an idea at this point, right? Give us some real-world examples.
That's exactly right. I mean, it starts with the high-tech greenhouse and then builds on that concept. And I mean that quite literally, because today, in the soft cover version of the book that's just recently come out, there are real examples of vertical farms, which I could not have written about when the hardcover version came out in 2010. So just in a year's time, we've had six examples of vertical farms coming into being from absolutely nothing.
Any in the U.S.?
There are two centers for vertical farms in the United States. One is in Chicago. It makes use of an old meatpacking building, and the company is called The Plant. And then there's another one in Seattle called Civesca, which is a two-story building and destined to become a much larger project in the future as well. But the ones that I'm personally familiar with, because I visited them, in addition to The Plant, I've been to the one in Korea, which is a government-funded facility. It's three stories tall, and it's designed to be a laboratory for learning how to do this on a much larger scale.
And why is it so much more efficient beyond the distribution issues?
Well, you get continuous growth of plants, for one thing, and you get to intensify the farming beyond weather-related events, right? You don't have to worry about droughts or floods. If you're designing the building correctly, you don't have to worry about invasion from insect pests. So you don't get a lot of loss of your crops once they're planted from the nurseries. And as a result, if you look at the ratio of success to failures in outdoor farming, in the best situation, by the way, and this is according to the United States Department of Agriculture, about 50% of what you plant never makes it out of the farm onto your table for various reasons. Okay, there's a whole bunch of things that can happen to your plants between the time you plant those seeds and the time you harvest those products and ship them off to the markets.
What we lay bare, then don't expose. Disguise our failure in poem or prose. What we can't see or not forecast. And then life goes on, this too will pass. We hide and get the loneliest view. A kid'll never come around and split the sky in two. Behind every timeliest clue, a riddle that we'll never solve won't split the sky in two. Goodbye, get along. Goodbye, get along.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Dr. Dixon Despommier. His book is The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century. How does eco-farming or vertical farming, how do you foresee that possibly cutting down on these pathogenic issues?
Well, for one thing, you don't use human feces as fertilizer, which is very commonly used outdoors, not in the United States, but in other countries, that's very common. The reason why you can keep out these pests is because there's a door on these farms. I mean, you can actually make them a double door. You can positively pressure these buildings to keep out the pathogens, just like we do from an intensive care ward at a hospital. And I know you're going to say, well, that's expensive, you know, and how are you going to afford this? Pat, the fact is that if you consider a business model as a 50% loss, that's what outdoor farming is, and that's in good times, all right? In bad times, and we've had some bad times this year, you can get 100% loss.
And we're probably going to see an increase of this with climate change because the weather patterns are going to be more extreme.
Exactly, exactly. So you don't have to worry about stuff like that when you do it indoors carefully. You have to do it carefully. So that's why these prototypes are incredibly important, because it's going to teach them how to be careful. So a lot of these companies are already growing leafy green vegetables that all you have to do is cut them at their base and put them in a plastic bag and sell them. You don't even have to wash them. They're that clean. So that saves a tremendous amount of worry as to what happens to my plants once they're harvested. You just ship them downstairs to the greengrocer and they're gone in an hour.
And speaking of washing, talk about some of the ways that you think we can start utilizing things like gray water to our advantage.
Sure. Well, there are other uses for vertical farms besides making edible plants available. For one thing, you can take advantage of the fact that plants take water through their roots, up through their stems, and then out through their leaves. The water that they take in through their roots, you wouldn't want to drink. But you'd drink the water that you could collect out of the atmosphere from the plant's transpiration activity. So if you took gray water, for instance, which is human feces and urine minus the solids, and all the dishwater and all the shower water and lots of other water sources, too, that are thrown together in terms of liquid municipal waste. And if you took the solids out, and we'll get to what to do with those in a second, and just took the gray water, which that is, and fed that gray water to plants that you don't eat, but collected the water in the atmosphere indoors, you could use the plants as a purification device. You could recover all of your gray water. New York City, by the way, throws away 1 billion gallons of gray water every day. I'm going to tell you that if you set up enough of these large water purification plants using plants as the final filter, so to speak, you could recover most of that water. And can you imagine how valuable that would be to a country like Jordan or to Abu Dhabi? And New York City just thinks that all they have to do is drill another tunnel up into the Catskills to take the water from the Catskills down to New York City so that they can have a constant source of water. Do you know that the reservoir system of New York is only 2 years full? If they had a two-year drought and New York City was forced to use water without having any replenishment, they'd run out of water in 2 years. Even if you think this is a crazy idea, I can guarantee you that farming is far crazier. It's absolutely far crazier. Just look 12,000 years ago at the human population, and look today at the results of farming and what it's meant for the human population, and you can see exactly where I'm coming from. An indoor farmer doesn't have to pray for rain.
Dr. Dixon DePommier, his book is The Vertical Farm. Dick, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's my extreme pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Bruce Springsteen and Fog Swamp.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.